open a public hearing on 5512, the Department of Energy. Also, committee members, please note that on the dais you have agendas for both, in the spirit of being environmentally sensitive, committee. We have schedules for 2 weeks, but they're on opposite sides. And please also note that you have Monday off.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Have we been bad or good, Mr. Chair?
Someone else has been bad. Oh, that's okay. Why you have. that's why you have Monday off. And with that, Mr. Greening, please begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. For record, Mike Graney, Director of the Department of Energy. And with me is Eric Kleiner from the Department of Administrative Services. This is a follow-up to one of the items we discussed yesterday. Senator Nelson asked about water availability, particularly with the number of new biofuel facilities being developed in eastern Oregon. And we did contact the Port of Morrow about their water availability, and I've got some information that I'd like to provide to the committee. And as I indicated yesterday, Senator Nelson, the port is pretty confident that it has the access to the water it needs for the projects that have contacted it and are likely to in the immediate future. Doesn't address some of the other broader water issues he raised, but in terms of that specific question there. Let me turn to the discussion of performance measures that we kind of skipped over yesterday, and that's on pages 23 through 26 of your materials. In particular, our performance measures, there's two benchmarks related to the department, one dealing with emergency response capability and the other dealing with carbon dioxide emissions. In turn, we have seven performance measures with three that were added by the 2005-07 legislature. Those seven deal with energy savings, carbon dioxide emissions, customer service, dealing with the quality of our programs, nuclear emergency drills, return on investment for the state funds generally and our programs in particular, application processing in terms of the timing and, again, customer satisfaction, and then finally schools in terms of the we do deal and work with schools a lot. We have a number of programs to work with schools, and schools obviously is an important part of the legislature's overall budget picture. So those are the seven performance measures. On page 25, we've gone through the results on each of those. In general, we are meeting or exceeding performance measures. There have been a couple of examples where, for example, in CO2, in the first couple of years of tracking the targets, our CO2 emissions statewide were still increasing. They are now beginning to decline. We need to maintain that progress. And, the energy efficiency and renewable energy programs, both for electricity and for transportation, are key components to continuing to make progress on CO2 emission. While discussing the performance measures, I also wanted to tie in Policy Option Package 100 that we discussed briefly yesterday. That's the package that would maintain and continue six positions that we have that are currently limited duration. We have had those positions for a number of years. We're asking to make those six permanent and to add four additional positions, three in the area of renewable resources because of the continuing level of work and the anticipated increased workload from the legislative package, and one to respond to the increased level of effort we've had from the business energy tax credit. We continue to have increasing demands in terms of numbers of applications and volumes of projects, and now complexity with growing renewable energy projects. And I provided have some additional material describing each of the positions in that policy option package and how they link to the specific performance measures. And each of those positions links to at least one of the performance measures, and a number of them link to two or more. The existing positions that we have are on the front first page, and then the four new positions that we're requesting as part of that package are on the second and third page. And again, I'd be happy to elaborate on any of those. But those, again, tie into the energy savings and return on investment primarily, and also the application process, and those are all related to projects, either through business energy tax credit or work with state buildings and schools and other constituents on energy efficiency and renewable energy projects. I could pause here and see if there's some questions or things you'd like me to elaborate on.
Any questions at this point?
I have a quick one,
Mr.
About the last one, the schools. I just want to make sure I'm understanding this right, Mike. So you work with the Energy Trust. You provide technical assistance, guidance to the Energy Trust, and they are actually doing the work in the schools?
No, the schools, Mr. Chairman, Representative Dingfelder, the schools program is run independent of the Energy Trust. It is funded with the public purpose charge, but that money goes directly or off the top, the first 10% of the public purpose charge, to the education service districts based on the school formula per student. And then we work directly with the education service districts and the individual schools on evaluating the measures, conducting audits, proceeding with projects, and we can use our other incentive programs with them, such as the loan program and the business tax credit, to finance energy savings measures.
Has there been any discussion about transferring that position or that oversight to the since the Energy Trust administers a lot of the public purposes programs? Have you had any discussion, or has there been discussion about having that administered through the
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dingfelder, not that I'm aware of. There's a couple of different sort of programs like that that go separate directly. The schools is one. There's low-income weatherization that goes directly to housing, and there's low-income housing new construction that also is operated by the Department of Housing. And we do, as I mentioned yesterday, work with the Energy Trust on general coordination of their efforts and ours across the board, but on schools, the money has gone traditionally directly to the ESDs, and that seems to be working.
Thank you.
Clarification on that issue. In the money going to the ESDs, is the policy package actually, the money goes to the ESDs, but are you given any resources in your current budget to actually work with the ESDs, or is it?
Mr. Chairman, we are. There's funding. There's limitation in our budget, and the ESDs do reimburse us for the expenses we incur for certifying the energy auditors, evaluating projects, and then if they use our loan or tax credit program, those have a fee structure to pay for our costs as well.
Then can you clarify for the policy package for the rural schools
the difference,
what you're going to be doing differently, and whether it's an issue of accelerating or if it's an issue of doing something differently?
Mr. Chairman, what we'll be doing is doing the same thing but working with different schools. We'll work with schools that do not receive the public purpose charge through their ESDs because they're not served by utilities to pay the public purpose charge. So we'll be working with schools that are served by municipal electric utilities or PUD associations or rural electric co-ops. And that's about a third of the state.
Not to get Senator Nelson's attention. but have any of those been approached in terms of contributing to this effort since there was some during the deliberations on the public purposes charge and not applying it to them, there were assurances that they would be devoting resources to this area, to this and other areas?
Mr. Chairman, yes. And when we received $1 million a few years ago as a result of one of the settlement cases from the 2000-2001 energy crisis that the Attorney General litigated, $1 million was devoted to rural schools, and that money was matched by the publicly owned utilities voluntarily, and they helped arrange for BPA to contribute $1 million as well. So it actually leveraged, turned into $3 million, and we're hoping that with that decision package, the rural schools package, that in turn could result in more money both from BPA and the utilities. I don't know if it would be a dollar-for-dollar match.
Any additional questions? Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, if there aren't additional questions on the performance measures, I could start on discussion of OMSI if you'd like.
Yes. And, Mr. Greeney, I asked that in the process of starting that discussion, if you could basically go through the history of this issue and some of the concerns that the agency may have and obviously how this package came about being proposed.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, the department provided a loan to OMSI in 1992, and it was a loan it was a time when OMSI moved into their new building on the east side of the river. They used to be up in Washington Park by the zoo. And the reason we provided a loan is the building incorporates many state-of-the-art energy efficiency features as well as renewable energy through groundwater heat pump heating system, heating and cooling system. Building uses nearly 40% less energy than a building built to the commercial code at that time. So it's both in terms of their operating costs and in terms of the demonstration technology to the many visitors that come, it's been very successful in that regard. The loan we provided was about $15 million. And when we provide a loan, we make sure that the there's security for the loan, especially large loans. And in this case, before making the loan, we had appraisals done of the property. We had an appraisal that indicated that the building and grounds were worth anywhere from $20 million if it stayed as a museum use to upwards of as much as $40 million. Because of the value of commercial property on the east side of the Willamette River there. So from sort of traditional lending guidelines, the property met our criteria. We had done an extensive review. We have an advisory committee composed of financial advisors that reviews large applications. We went through the history of OMSI's financial operations, which had been very good. For the first 3 years, then after the loan, and that loan payment with the $15 million loan, their loan payments due were about $1.1 million a year. And for the first 3 years, they met those payments, met every payment due. Early 1996, we had the Great Flood in Portland, and it did substantial damage to the building. Perhaps just as seriously, the museum had to close down for over 4 months, which meant lost revenues, lost business traffic. People just stopped going to OMSI, and it just sort of falls off the list of things you do. That had very significant impacts in terms of their financial situation, and they have steadily improved, but they've been recovering from that. They've not been able to make the loan payments for the most part since then. We've had what we call a forbearance agreement with them that they've provided $250,000 a year in partial loan payments, and when we issue make a loan, we issue state general obligation bonds. So our obligation to pay the bonds has continued over this period of time. We've been making those payments using both the small payment that OMSI could provide, and also the using department program reserves. Whenever we make a loan to anybody, there's a slight surcharge to build into the reserves for this program, and they're dedicated to the program and can't be used for anything else. So those reserves have helped make the payments. In addition, three times over the period since 1997, the legislature has provided general fund. And I think the total general fund, it was in increments of $1 million or $1.5 million three different times, for a total of I think $3.9 million total to supplement OMSI's payments so we could continue to make the bond payments. At the same time, the interest continues to accrue on the debt, so that the amount that OMSI owes is still about $15 million in terms of the paper debt. The bond balance is less than that. The bond balance, I think, is currently about $13 million. Is that right?
$12.5 million.
The proposal you have before you, OMSI recently, within the last few months, received a generous bequest, and unlike most of the bequests they've received, this doesn't have limitations on what they can use it for, at least in terms of operations versus specific exhibits. Many of the donations they receive are targeted to, I want an exhibit on science, or I want an exhibit on space, or something like that. And frequently, foundations and other donors don't like to give donations to pay off what they consider either just basic operating expenses or existing debt. So this is an unusual opportunity. The full amount of that is $4.6 million, and OMSI is willing to pay that, and they're not under our current forbearance agreement. That's substantially more than they would have to pay. And the proposal in the program option package is for the state to match that payment with $4.6 million of general fund. All that money would be used to pay down the principal of the loan balance. We'd actually use the money to pay the bonds, that much of the bonds. But by paying down the principal, and then we would write off the department the accrued interest that has not been able to be paid. And that accrued interest is nearly $3 million. So that would leave a balance of about $5.5 million of loan that OMSI still owes. But with that $5.5 million, OMSI could maintain that loan balance with in the range of the payments they're making now. It would be about $300,000 a year to carry that loan balance. It would also give them the opportunity. It's a much lower loan balance, so it reduces both the state's exposure in terms of money at risk, and it would give put OMSI in a better financial situation in terms of their balance sheets and financial documents, in terms of soliciting donations that might enable them to, in fact, retire this loan so that it wouldn't have to continue to be carried. But if it were carried, we're confident they would be able to maintain this based upon their performance over the last 6-7 years, even with the financial difficulties they've been in. And that's the basic situation, sort of in a nutshell.
Another portion of this issue, Mr. Graney, is there's been an indication that you've been utilizing the reserves for that particular fund to pay for the interest that OMSI is unable to pay. Is that correct? Or?
Well, Mr. Chairman, we've actually been using it to make the bond payments. And those bond payments include principal and interest on the bonds. The interest rate is on the bonds is a little over 5%.
But there's some indication that you can't continue to do that indefinitely. Can you explain that?
Yes, we do have adequate reserves at the moment. We're within the range of 3 to 5% of our outstanding portfolio. That's the financial guidelines from the Treasurer and our own financial advisor. But I am concerned that, I mean, we have had to draw down reserves and use those, I think, for the long term, and these bonds will continue unless we retire them. In advance would continue another 10 to 15 years. The bonds, yeah, 2028, so more than 20 years. And I think with having to keep reserves dedicated to this amount of a loan will constrain our ability to make other loans, especially other large loans for biofuel facilities or wind projects that have expressed interest to us.
This might be a good time if you'd like to. Who would you like to bring up from OMSI to maybe?
Or does anybody have any questions? Okay.
Chairman, we could call Nancy Stuber, who's the president of OMSI, and she'd like to.
Yeah, they're just going to answer questions. Maybe a little bit.
I'll wait till after the opening comments, and then.
Please start and introduce yourself.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Nancy Stuber. I'm the president and CEO of OMSI, Oregon Museum of Science and Industry, and pleased to have the opportunity to talk with you this morning. OMSI has been in the community in Oregon for more than 60 years, and I'm privileged to say that I've been part of OMSI for 25 years, been the president for the last six. And so it is an organization that is doing good work, has always had very strong grassroots community support. And I think that it's just this is a great opportunity for us to move OMSI forward and to continue on this path. We have been really committed to the public understanding of science, and that's a mission that I'm very passionate about. We have been able to do that very successfully over the years. And, you know, when you are with an organization for more than 25 years, you've lived through the high times and the low times, and I've done both of those things. And I'm pleased to report today that OMSI has survived and through the recent difficulties and the economic recession, and today is strong and growing and continuing to thrive. We have a clear vision for the future. We have direction, and we're just really pleased that we've been able to do that. It hasn't been easy. It's been through cost cutting and belt tightening and very careful business analysis of what we've done, and some pretty entrepreneurial new ventures as well. Last year, we were able to reach more than 1 million people in the state. That's both through the destination in Portland, but also through outreach programs that go to every county in Oregon, into every school district. Those might be through our residential camp programs that we operate in the high desert, in the Cascades, at the Oregon coast, or through outreach programs that go into schools and libraries and communities throughout the state, go to state fairs, county fairs, that sort of thing. I'm especially proud that we've been able to do that with partners throughout the state. So, for instance, the Cow Creek Tribe has enabled us to take an inflatable planetarium to Drain into Southern Oregon coastal communities, where kids can now experience the same thing in immersing in astronomy that any student in Oregon, in Portland, can at the OMSI Planetarium. The Libraries of Eastern Oregon are a great partner, and together we've been able to win several million dollars in federal support to connect communities, not only schools but now libraries, with distance learning technology. We're even able to do a live link with the International Space Station when Oregon astronaut Don Pettit was on board, and he was able to talk with kids from his school in Silverton who had could now see someone who had come from their school with their same science teacher on the International Space Station. So really important learning opportunities that we're able to extend through those partnerships. With OHSU, we're reaching out to students in the biosciences, helping them to understand the career opportunities there. With additional funding, we were able to bring students from all across the state to spend the night in OMSI. 280 kids last year came from Klamath Falls, for instance, to spend the night at OMSI and tour the submarine. So it's that kind of work that we're doing, not always so visible to you if you aren't involved every day, but we know that we're having an impact, and our commitment is to help young people really have access to the science and technology skills that they'll need for the economy of the future. And that's why I respectfully ask you today to support this proposal that's going forward. It is critical for OMSI to be able to continue this work. Mike did a good job of describing the history and how we got to this point. This is a critical point for OMSI. The growing debt burden that we have is not sustainable. We know that as it grows, we anticipate that we will have a negative audit opinion that at some point in our near future will question OMSI's ability to survive under these conditions. And what that does is it triggers a downward financial spiral, beginning with the inability for us to receive a disbursement from the endowment fund that OMSI has currently held by the Oregon Community Foundation. And under the terms of that endowment, we wouldn't be able to receive disbursements without some continued support. That would extend to other foundations and then to individual donors who would lose confidence in OMSI's ability to continue. We've been close to that point before in the mid-90s when the flood happened in Portland, and we know the spiral that is initiated then, and that would really threaten OMSI's existence. We are confident that we have a proposal that can solve this problem, we believe, for OMSI and for the state. We appreciate the partnership that we've had with the state until now, and we hope that we can continue with something that this would allow us one time to resolve this issue so we would not be back to the state asking for debt relief or debt support. Instead, we would be able to manage this independently by applying these funds to principal, pay this loan down to a balance that we know that we can sustain and have a track record of doing so. So I appreciate your consideration and am pleased to answer any questions.
Unless we have a great coincidence, that Neil Bryant, that I thought was Neil Bryant, is now in the room. but if the gentleman next to you is not another Neil Bryant, does he have anything to say?
I would like to introduce Paul Carlson, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Paul is the Senior Vice President for Support and Administration. He has been here at OMSI managing our finances through this period. And Paul.
Could I ask one question?
Yes.
Before
this?
Those kids you talked about from Klamath came back motivated and excited about science. So I certainly hope and urge the continued expansion of your outreach program to rural Oregon, because that's a very important part of your future.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Girard, I absolutely agree. And in fact, some of the programs I'd be happy to tell you about are doing just that. We're looking for additional funds to expand that outreach even further.
Great, thank you.
Good morning.
Up again for the record.
My name is Paul Carlson, Senior Vice President of Support and Administration for OMSI. Happy to be here today to answer any questions you might have on the finances of OMSI. I think yesterday in Mike Graney's comments, he used the word opportunity. I can't stress that enough. I think this is a unique opportunity given OMSI's funding and the nature of that funding. We have a unique opportunity now to, if you will, put an exclamation point on this collaboration we've had over the last almost 10 years regarding this debt issue. From a financial point of view, the debt is a serious problem for OMSI. As an example, we have any business needs a line of credit normally for its normal business cycle. We have, in fact, been turned down three times in obtaining a line of credit. This has been a real challenge for us, and getting a resolution to this debt issue would certainly open up our financial options and assist in our future growth. I think there is a reasonable question out there as to OMSI's ability to pay under any new structure. I think the our history of payments over the last 9 years speaks to that. Through good times and bad, we've been religious about making those debt payments, and we feel confident that we can do so going forward.
Do you have any type of a long-range business plan that you've put into effect that members of the committee that we're interested to look at?
We absolutely do. We are, in fact, starting our second five-year plan, if you will, having just completed the original one. But that that original document is available, as is will be the second one, should anyone request it.
Could you provide that to the committee?
Absolutely.
Secondarily, the bequest, which was basically a broad request, and you could use it for any purposes, I believe, beneficial to OMSI, you've actually paid from that bequest about $1.5 million, I believe, on the principal. That's correct.
That is correct.
And your intention would be to utilize the rest of that as part of the whole thing would be part of the $4.5 million payment, or approximately $4.5 million payment.
That's correct.
Okay. Let's see if there's... Yes, Representative Nowak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I actually don't have a lot of specific questions, although I understand that some of the committee members do. Ms. Stuber took the time, actually before the session started, to sit down and walk me through the proposal. So I appreciate having that level of detail. And I'm supportive of this package. If the committee can find a better way to take advantage of this opportunity, I'd certainly be willing to look at that and encourage the chair to pursue those. But I have to make something of a disclosure, I guess. My daughter is one of the millions of people who enjoy OMSI's programs and benefit from them. She learned what physics were without even knowing the words when she was just a kindergartner, attending the destination, as Ms. Stuber defines it, in Portland. And in the fourth grade, I was amazed. Her class went to an OMSI camp on the coast for a three-day science lesson. And in the fourth grade, she was dissecting squid under the tutelage of their teachers and was able to come home and describe the whole process. And I would echo what you said. More than the specific things she learned, just the notion that she was excited about science as a result of those experiences is worth a lot. And that that is available to students all over the state is just fabulous. The other comment I'd make is that I think the state needs to step up and do something about this, because we were partners in the beginning with OMSI when we made the bond financing available to them. And frankly, I think we've been complicit in participating in some of the troubles that OMSI has developed as a result. Given the topics that we've got going on in the Capitol these days, and without meaning any offense to anyone, in some ways I think we as the state, as your lender, have operated in some ways like a payday lender. We have helped you roll this debt over and over and over, and I think because of that, we have some obligation to help them take advantage of this opportunity to get out of it and get it behind all of us. However you structure that, Mr. Chair, I would like to see us fix it.
I would say it's probably the intent of this chair to try to find a way to fix it, but in a reality that Representative Nolan is the co-chair of Ways and Means, but in the reality also that any time you stick several million dollars into the budget that's atypical from a normal expenditure, it is hard to keep it in the budget until the end of the process. Representative Burley.
Okay. No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator.
I'm doing 501c3 status, and I'm curious if, and I don't need specific numbers, but if you could generalize it for me, how much of your income in recent years comes from admission or other types of fees for access to the facility and with the summer camps or whatever else you do, and how much comes from donations or fundraisers, things like that, and then how has that changed over time, the balance between the two?
Chairman Devlin, Senator Larkin, approximately, and this varies year to year, we generally raise in terms of donations $2 to $3 million a year, not including federal grants. Federal grants are a large portion. They also constitute of $2 to $3 million a year, and the rest is fee income. What was not mentioned earlier in terms of the trajectory that we're on and the dangers there is that federal grants would also be at risk should we not arrive at some resolution down the road to this problem. But generally, donations run $2 to $3 million a year out of a $17 to $19 million budget.
So the rest of that then would be admission fees or something of
various types.
And then lastly, has that ratio been about the same over, I don't know, the last 20 years or so, or has it changed?
I think the individual components have changed, but if you put federal grants and donations together, that has been pretty fairly constant.
One more, if I could, Mr. Chair. Then I guess what I'm aiming towards here is whether or not it's become more difficult to meet your debts because of your reliance on, for instance, a federal grant, which might not be as you may not be able to rely on as much as you could admission fees, which maybe are more constant over the years. I mean, has that affected all your ability to pay your debts, or is that not a factor?
Chairman Devlin, Senator Avakian, we have, as I said, through good times and bad, been able to pay the forbearance amount for the last 9 years, and that's amounted to over, I'd say, $2.2 million, not including the $1.5 million that was paid last year out of the bequest. My first career was with one of the largest for-profit companies in the world, and I've spent the last 15 years in nonprofit management. Being responsible for the financial health of a nonprofit is really living on the edge in many senses. So we are constantly reviewing our cost structure and our business models to make sure that we optimize everything that we can. We push very hard on the attendance side of things, and that is somewhat dependent on the availability of exhibits that we have coming into the museum. It is also, as you mentioned, dependent on our success in getting federal grants, which we use both for programs and to build exhibits that we then rent out to other museums. So federal grants are becoming harder to obtain. There's more competition in that area. On the other hand, I think we're being much more successful in terms of attendance. We just finished the Star Wars exhibit, which was our broke all records for the quarter that it was, calendar quarter it was in the museum, by a long shot. So we keep pushing on the attendance side of things, on the fee side of things.
Stuber, one thing by the way of history, and I believe many of the people here on the committee are aware of this, but you had indicated that you've been, this is now your third decade at OMSI. I remember when OMSI was up on the hill with the Zoo and the Forestry Center, and at that time I was actually on the Metro Council. And when OMSI moved to the other side of the river, there was a general feeling that OMSI, in a sense, had bit off more than it could chew. But I don't know if there was actually a public recognition of the difficulties that you had on the hill, so to speak, up there. The zoo was expanding literally every year with public funds. There was a limited amount of parking. Anybody that knows anything about the history of the hill up there knows that you were pretty much landlocked, and that any expansions on the hill are relatively expensive because there is a very clear issue with landslides on the hill. So preventing those landslides makes expansion difficult. One of the reasons why some of the earlier expansions to the zoo, I think, were very expensive too. So in some ways, as a nonprofit, I don't think you had much choice but to move from the hill. Could you comment on that? Since you were there, you weren't in the same capacity, obviously, but you might remember those days.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We also added a light rail station on the hill.
I appreciate your recollection of all of those challenges. You're right. I did work at OMSI in Washington Park, and for all the reasons that you say, it was very difficult to expand. The need to expand was there. My job at that time was to bring in temporary exhibits, and we brought in the very first major temporary exhibit, the Muppets, the science of the Muppets that OMSI had ever done. And in fact, the crowds lined up down the street and around the block, and we saw 600,000 visitors that year in a building that had a projected capacity of 200,000. So the demand was there, the need to expand was really clear, and for all the reasons that you describe, it was not possible to expand to the level that OMSI needed on the facility there. And I believe since we've been on the east side of the river in a much larger space, the fact that we're serving 1 million people speaks to that demand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe I could ask a question of you first. Is this largely the balance of our committee, and are there other people who do want to?
We're
going to
come back for two items, not after today. We're going to finish it all today. Mr. Graney is going to come back and talk a little bit about the package that's for state buildings, which they have 8 positions involved with, and maybe make a closing. Plus, we have two more parties from the public to testify, one on this issue and one on a separate issue, actually. So,
okay, maybe I can just ask a question, Mr.
Yes.
Chair. Would you be able to be the most appropriate person to answer questions about some of the things in this document, or is there somebody else who's going to testify later I should ask?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clem, we were happy to answer those questions, and Paul Carlson in particular can answer the financial questions in detail.
Okay, please.
I just have a few questions. I think I got one answered, which was the capital campaigns that you do, on average you raise $2 to $3 million a year in private fundraising. Is that what I heard? Or not capital campaigns, your annual fundraising activities.
Chairman Devlin, Representative Clem, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Regarding, Mr. Chair, follow-up, regarding the cost overruns, I think was the term used here, it looks to me like once you add the additional construction issues plus, I think it was a legal settlement, upgrades to the heating and cooling system and the legal settlement, plus a bank action, it looks like, that decreased the interest earned. We're talking about a 33% overall overrun in the budget, roughly, from 35.4 million up to 51 million. And I had some questions about that. Are we done with the legal actions completely? We've recouped everything we could. It almost looks to me like we actually paid the contractor, not the other way around in this case. And I'm curious about whether we're done with the legal actions completely and who paid who in that particular lawsuit.
Chairman Devlin, Representative Plum, predates me, so I don't have the exact answer in terms of the contractor. But we are completely finished with any legal action.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The line says the construction overrun resulted from increased costs and the settlement of a lawsuit with the general contractor due to construction delays, so it kind of makes me think we had to pay them, which is unfortunate, obviously. Mr. Chair, just a couple more. I apologize. On the issue of the short-term government securities earnings going from 8% down to 5%, is that an action that we still had a choice, or were we sort of locked in and once they made the change, we couldn't really do anything about it, or did we have a decision on whether to go forward?
Chairman Devlin, Representative Clem, my understanding of that situation was that we were locked in, that the decision of the banks at that time was post any point at which we had options available to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two more. What is the average admission fee charge for somebody who wants to come in? It's been a long time since I've been there, unfortunately. In fact, the last time was when I came as a staff person to Senator Wyden to view the flood damage in 96. So I'm aware of it all. Just for my hip boots, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clem, the current admission price, if you're just coming and paying to come to OMSI, is $9 for an adult. There are many packages that you can add to that for other attractions, the OmniMax Theater and other things, and then, of course, a discount rate for members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then the last one, if
yes.
I might. There's some language used here, and I just wanted to see in folks' mind and maybe someone else in the audience would be more appropriate. I'm not sure. But the language is the legislature committed to appropriate general funds. There's another place that says the legislature says without the promised support from the legislature, and I'm new, so I don't know what that means. Does that mean there was a resolution? Does that mean a committee said it? Does it mean a chair of a committee said it? Does it mean, 31 members of the House said it? What does that really mean in people's minds?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clem, I would ask that that question be directed to our friend here as he testifies, because he was part of the legislature during that time and can probably answer that question best.
That's all my questions, Mr. Chair.
Any additional?
Sure.
Okay. Thank you very much, and I'll call up Mr. Bryant next. And then to make sure that we get to him, I'll call up the other gentleman that wants to testify, and then we'll call Mr. Graham for today.
Good morning. I'm Neil Bryant. I'm an attorney in Bend, and I've been on the OMSI board for the past 6 years. As my term expired in 2001, I was asked to serve on the board and accepted. And for the last 5 years, I've been the chair of the Debt Retirement Committee, and it's a committee I want to see go out of existence. In answer to your question, in 1997, the Speaker of the House, Lynn Lundquist, and the present Senate, Brady Adams, came to me and handed me a file and said, basically, OMSI's in default under the terms of their agreement with the Department of Energy. They're running in the red. They've got additional debt with banks and other problems. And they've now replaced their CEO president. They're bringing on a new board, and they've got a business plan. We'd like you to review it and then make a recommendation as to what you think we should do. So I did that, and I was chairing judiciary at the time. And in my private practice, we do foreclosure work. And so took a look at what the security was, and at that time it was the building. And if someone bought it, they'd tear it down because they'd use it for another purpose. So it probably had a value of $6 or $7 million. Well, at that time, the debt was over $18 million. And we didn't get the submarine. The submarine was on a lease and arrangement with the federal government, and so that wasn't part of our security. But more importantly, no one wanted to close OMSI. Neil and Mary Bryant's children went to the beach, things that Representative Nolan talked about when they were little, and it's one of the few times in our lives that our teenage son would get up at 5 in the morning to go out to, the tide was out and you could see the best tide pools. And Brady and Lynn and just about everyone in the legislature had some positive experience with OMSI for themselves or their children or their grandchildren. And the business plan looked like it could work, and it went something like this. They would go on a very quick fundraising effort to get rid of about $3 million of bank loans that were in default, lines of credits and whatnot. And they negotiated and settled those and then raised the money on about 60 cents on the dollar. They would cut their expenses and bring in a business plan, and they did that where they could break even and make some payments towards the debt. And the amount that they could afford to make was $250,000 a year. They also sold their improvements. They had moved from the Washington Park site, but they owned the improvements. And they sold those to the city, and that money was used to reduce the debt. So that was their commitment. And what the legislature decided to do in 97, then again in 99, was to basically use $1.5 million in general fund to make the other payment on the debt. So you have the $500,000 biennium from OMSI and the rest. And, of course, legislators can't bind future legislators, but that was the idea. And OMSI was hoping that at some point there would be some other way to get rid of that anchor around their neck, because it does affect everything else they do, including their financial statements and what their auditors are kind enough to remind them. Well, when the recession hit, of course, the state support ended, and you heard from my granny about the use of the reserves. Now this manna from heaven has come in the form of this bequest, and it's through the hard work of OMSI that they got that. This individual had no family, but he spent time at OMSI and appreciated what they did. And I think he gave one half of his estate to OMSI and the other half to the Humane Society. And so it gives them the ability to offer what they've offered. And I know $4.6 million is a lot of money, but it alleviates the state from having this obligation too in the way that they currently have, and it's an answer that needs to be completed. So then I think OMSI can flourish in other ways that it hasn't been able to in the past few years, because there's always this uncertainty and it's always there, and it does affect their grant applications and the other efforts that they try to make. So I don't know if there's another source of the funds. In the past, the Debt Retirement Committee has talked about trying to use lottery. No one was really excited about that, especially in the economic development area. So
our highest rated bonds now.
Yeah. So I think this is a good fit, and we've talked to the people that have been in the building have talked to about every member of the legislature, and they understand the problem, and they seem encouraging. So my hope is that this committee will say, yep, it's time, and let's do it, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Ms. Bryant, I'm glad to have that history, because I think it helps the committee. You brought up one other issue there that I don't know how it impacted OMSI, but I know that it impacted a lot of other nonprofits, is that as the state went through the recession and obviously had a lot of impact on Oregonians, and the state had to make a lot of cuts in their budgets. A lot of nonprofits went through a period of a couple of years when donations went down considerably because of people just don't donate. And also a lot of, I don't want to characterize OMSI as an amusement event, but a lot of things that are of similar nature suffered because the public did not attend in the same numbers. And I would expect that OMSI probably experienced at least some of that. We had some real issues in terms of the the lodging industry during that period in the Portland metropolitan area, and fewer conventions, I believe, than normal. And so, I mean, I think the committee is looking for a solution, and I know the co-chairs are looking for a solution, and I believe we have the support of most of the members in both chambers, actually, to find a solution, and the leadership. So we're hoping to find that. What assurances do we have if we're able to find a solution that basically gets OMSI back to relatively maybe a third of their existing debt on this, approximately a little bit more than a third of their debt, that they won't come back again?
Well,
I'm supposed to ask these questions.
I understand. Mr. Chair, you're right. The recession also hurt OMSI and all museums. Attendance went down, and although they had basically the same number of contributors, they contributed less because they had less discretionary income. And so that was a challenge. The strength of OMSI is its history and the people it has touched and its list of contributors and who's out there. And they do a good job of communicating with their significant donors. And I sense a commitment that we overcome this hurdle. And although the payments go from $250 a year to $320,000, it will happen. And Nancy Stuber is wonderful in this regard. She's dedicated to OMSI and makes a great sales pitch. And she has credibility in the Portland business community. The high-tech people really like OMSI because of their emphasis on science. And as I mentioned, there aren't many children in the state that don't have some touching of OMSI during their school experience. So it can't be an absolute guarantee, but it is certainly the intent of the existing board and the people who have tried to solve this problem in the past. So that's probably the best assurance that we can give.
Any final questions for Mr. Bryant? Seeing none, thank you very much, and
thank
good
you.
To see you again.
I'll be around.
We're going to bring up a person, I believe, on an unrelated portion of the budget, but just to make sure that he gets an opportunity to testify, and then we'll come back to Mr. Graney for about 15-20 minutes. Mr. Bauman, is it?
Rather on the other policy package.
And if you could limit yourself to about 3 to 4 minutes, it would be appreciated.
I can do that. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeremiah Bauman. I'm an environmental and energy advocate for OSPIRG, the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, and I wanted to speak just very briefly in support of the governor's recommended budget, and in particular several of the policy packages for the Department of Energy. I think that there's already been a lot of talk, and it'll be even more this session, of the critical need to solve our country's and our state's dependence on fossil fuels, which includes problems ranging from our dependence on foreign oil to the rising and increasingly volatile prices of coal and natural gas, and now more and more the threat of global warming that's already affecting our sea levels and snowpacks. This subcommittee is where the budget process interfaces with these problems. And while I think a lot of the public attention and media attention has been on some very big and important packages of policies that include tax incentives and standards for both biofuels and renewable electricity, there are also some very important budget components of Oregon's overall strategy for energy independence and for cutting global warming pollution. And that is really because the Department of Energy is central both to solving these problems and to making sure that Oregon is positioned to take advantage of the opportunities that come with those solutions. Simply put, energy efficiency is the cheapest and most effective way to cut global warming pollution and cut fossil fuel dependence. Renewable energy is an incredible economic development tool that makes sure we get jobs, economic development, and savings for consumers and businesses as we address these problems. And the Department of Energy plays a critical role in the state in both of those arenas. I also want to point out that a key component of the governor's plan and our overall approach to energy solutions is state leadership on these issues, not only because the state is directing these solutions and administering a lot of them, but because the state is such a large owner and operator of buildings and vehicles. The state is one of the largest energy consumers, and therefore can play a leadership role simply by implementing our own the policies we advocate at state agencies. So with that in mind, Osberg strongly supports the governor's recommended budget, particularly policy packages 100, 101, and 103. 101, which is the $2.3 million in general fund requests for energy efficiency in state buildings, I think is one of the most important ideas to come before the Ways and Means Committee in the environmental arena. The governor's goal is to cut energy consumption in state buildings 20% by 2010, which is an incredibly important leadership role. As I mentioned, energy efficiency is so important. I think it sometimes doesn't get quite the glamorous spotlight that renewable energy gets because you don't have the fancy technology going up all over the state. But it's actually more cost-effective and a faster way to solve these problems. And it has the added benefit of helping the state budget because over the not too long-term, energy efficiency improvements pay for themselves. Policy package 103, the $2 million in solar projects for schools and in energy efficiency projects for rural schools are also very, very important. Solar energy is an arena where Oregon could really be a leader in the country. We have more solar potential even in the rainiest parts of our state than Germany and Japan, which are the world leaders in solar power right now. And we've got a lot of roof space on public buildings, particularly schools, to benefit from that. So that's an important place. And putting solar projects on schools gives you a increased benefit because you have the option of Oregon school children learning about solar power and learning about renewable energy and learning about a different way to generate energy from an early age. As I believe was already mentioned, the energy efficiency for rural schools is particularly important because Oregon has long had a leadership position on energy efficiency measures, including through our Energy Trust of Oregon. But unfortunately, those programs don't serve a lot of the rural areas of the state because the consumer-owned utilities aren't part of that program. So this is an important way to start extending the benefits we're already providing for other schools to rural schools. And then finally, I'll note Policy Package 100, which is $1.3 million to stabilize staffing, is important to deal with the surging interest that Oregonians across the state are showing in energy efficiency and renewable energy, and increasingly turning appropriately to the department for help in navigating all their options. And so it's important that we meet that demand because they're stepping up and we should be doing the same. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Mr. Graney, if you'd please come forward. And my understanding is that we might need to, well, we not might, we should hear from you more about the package on energy efficiency in state office buildings, and also maybe some comments relative to, well, I wouldn't maybe refer to it quite as a ranking, but in terms of where you see the highest priority amongst those packages.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And the three packages.
For the record, again, Mike Graney from Department of Energy. The package on state buildings, and I think Mr. Bauman explained it very well, better than I could. This is an effort that we are working with state buildings already, but this would accelerate our efforts. The governor's goal is to for us to address all state buildings as quickly as possible. Realistically, we plan to deal with the largest ones first. There's over 1,000 larger state buildings and over 5,000 buildings entirely. The package that we put together, both the general fund and the increase in staff, is to allow that acceleration over the next 4 years, so that the largest 1,000 largest buildings would be analyzed and followed up with energy savings measures. I recognize that it's a significant staff increase, as well as general fund, and it's one that, depending on your decision in terms of both funding and staff increases, we would continue to work with state buildings and do as much as we could with the existing tools we have and with whatever of that package you provided. But it's a key policy reason in terms of energy savings for the reasons that Jeremiah mentioned.
I guess in terms of overall ranking of our packages, we really need 100, our base program option package, for our to retain the existing staff that have been on limited duration basis, to make those permanent, and to add the four positions that first package, as well as the OMSI package, for the reasons you heard this morning. The OMSI package continues, or the OMSI issue, not only causes OMSI, of course, difficulty, it restricts our ability to use the loan program to a maximum advantage for energy efficiency and renewable energy projects because of the need to set aside sufficient reserves just related to the OMSI loan. So those would be the two I'd say that are critical. The schools is important because it fills a gap that can't be addressed by the public purpose charge. And the state buildings is one that, I don't want to say it's less important, but we'd be able to work to the level of whatever you gave us in that regard, or whatever decision you made. And we do use our low-interest loan program and a tax credit program with state buildings, and would continue to do so.
And I have a question from Representative Dingfelter, Representative Clem, and then I have a few of my own.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I want to just comment and say that I've been working very closely with the Department of Energy for the past 4 years, and really commend the director for his leadership, and also many of the things that we've asked him to do weren't in his budget either this session or last session. So I will say that he's really responded very well to the requests, especially from some of us pesky legislators who've been trying to expand our energy independence in many areas. But with that, so I just want to say to the committee that for especially those of us who are on the policy committee, that Policy Package 100 is what I see as an essential element if we are, in fact, going to expand some of the very good tax incentives that we have for reducing energy consumption in the state, especially the Betsy and the Retsy. And I do know that his staff is fairly overwhelmed right now because the program has been so successful. So one of those good news, bad news type stories. The question I have in particular, and just so you, I certainly echo the comments that were made about OMSI and feel that they have been, the 13 years that I've worked with OMSI, a real asset to the community, especially in helping further understanding of science in the education realm. And especially what I've seen is the cuts to our school programs of science. OMSI has helped fill that niche, especially since they don't have the funds to do a lot of the special science projects or field trips, and I know that OMSI has been a valuable tool. Regarding Policy Package 101, two questions I have. First is, from reading the information that you have, it's unclear to me what is the payback period for the savings. In other words, I know that it's going to cost us up front to make these investments, but how long is the payback period once we actually implement those energy efficiency upgrades in the state buildings?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dingfelter, that will, of course, depend on the specific building, but our experience, state buildings are like other commercial buildings, and they're we found substantial energy savings on especially the heating ventilation systems in older buildings, lighting systems to a lesser extent. In some cases, the paybacks literally as little as a matter of months. In other cases, it would be some years, but I would think by some it would be well less than 10 years. And in many cases, it's to the extent it's heating systems or heating and cooling systems, it's typically no more than a few years, 2 to 3 years.
Follow up? The other question I had, and I realize that there's going to be a range depending on the building, is reading through this package occurred to me, could this not be done through a competitive bid process? And in specific, if I'm not clear why we would have permanent full-time staff if we're looking at doing these audits, and then this is not, I mean, there will be upgrades that will be needed, but this is a huge push. I mean, over 5,000 buildings. So is there some way we can put this out to competitive bid, and then we don't have obviously the long-term commitment as far as full-time FTE?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dinkfelder, our intent would be to use the private sector as much as possible. The staff would primarily not be doing building audits. They would be doing some, but we would put it out to bid. And the schools model that we extrapolated our figures from in terms of staffing needs does that. They use energy service companies, energy providers that are expert in this area. We do the oversight. I think you could look at how many staff and how you phase them in and whether they're permanent or not. So I think that's reasonable to look at.
Clarification, Mr. Chair. So this $22,300,000 level, that includes the cost to hire the actual contractor, put out the RFP, go through the whole bidding process?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Felder, that's correct.
And final question.
Yes.
So would that be just in this biennium, or do you anticipate doing 5,732 buildings in the next biennium, or that would be over several biennia?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dinkfelder, that would be over several biennia. And that was why we made the request as a permanent position. We would need that to do that level, we would need people for at least two or three biennium.
Representative Flynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had just a question, making sure I understand the public purpose funds, and maybe you could walk me through it. I assume it has something to do with if you live in a certain area and pay into a certain utility, it can only be used on schools in that area or something. Sure.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clem, that's correct. Customers of Portland General Electric and PacifiCorp, on your bill each month, there's a, along with various other charges on the back page, there's a 3% charge for a public purpose charge. And that funding, most of the money, probably about three-fourths of it, goes to the Energy Trust, which is a nonprofit organization that runs energy efficiency and renewable energy projects. Some goes directly to the energy service districts and some to our Department of Housing for low-income weatherization programs. And the statute that established that provides that I believe at least 80% of those funds have to be used in the service area of the paying utility. So you can have a little non-coverage, but for the most part, that money is spent in those service areas.
Mr. Chair, so are there, using those funds, such projects as we're describing an additional grant program to kind of make up for the fact they can't get those funds? Are those projects going on then in those service areas using those funds currently, like solar panels being installed and things?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clinton, yes, in PG and Pacific service area, they're doing energy efficiency and renewable energy projects in schools. And we have worked with publicly owned utilities, but they don't have this kind of money. So the tools we have for them are just our low interest loan program and the tax credit program.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I'm just trying to get my head around this. So the ratepayers in an area are to some extent charging themselves and paying for things in schools in their area. And what we're talking about here is there are some areas where there is no such mechanism, so we would use all taxpayers to pay for, you know, the projects in the other areas.
Chairman, Representative Clem, that's correct.
Of questions. In terms of the buildings that would be targeted, would that include higher education?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Of the 1,000 buildings that potentially would be involved, do we know how many of them are state-owned versus leased?
Mr. Chairman, yes. We have that information or can get it. I don't know offhand, but we would look at, I think, both owned and leased. In the case of leased, we'd work with the building owners to when we need their permission, and two, in many cases, they're willing to finance the improvements.
Could we anticipate that in terms of identifying buildings that most of the new structures are relatively new on the Capitol Mall, and those that have been recently within the last 10 years,
basically like the old public service building that went through extensive renovations, and the Department of Justice building that's, I don't know if it's still going through extensive renovations, and the Department of Human Services, which is only probably about a decade old, that most of those would have most of the things that you would want in them incorporated?
Mr. Chairman, they would certainly have...
For the ones that were retrofitted.
They would, yes, Mr. Chairman. I mean, there may be cost-effective opportunities there, but in terms of priorities, I think we'd start with the older buildings that use a lot more energy that have not been addressed.
I worked in the public service building in about 1969, and it was very efficient during the summer. There was no air conditioning. It was about 110 degrees.
We're trying to balance.
Another couple of follow-ups to this is that if you identify relatively minor things, that's one question. But if you identify major things in buildings, you've identified them, but of course you haven't. There's no money in this budget to actually do the actual capital improvements that are necessary, or regardless of what the size of them are. I mean, in many cases, if we were talking about maybe upgrading a heating and cooling system, we might be talking, depending on the size of the building, tens of thousands of dollars, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars. And we have a very extensive planning for capital improvements, and actually for dealing with deferred maintenance, even though we don't do enough of the deferred maintenance. Even though we could accelerate this, what evidence is there we could accelerate the funding to actually do the projects that would be necessary?
Well, Mr. Chairman, a couple of things. We do have tools for some of the financing. For example, our energy loan program combined with the tax credit using the pass-through mechanism that I mentioned yesterday for the public
sector.
That
would assume that the Betsy's would become marketable. Or
yes, yes. But we certainly have the low-interest loan program, and we are, as part of the limitation request, there's an increase in the loan program, anticipating deferred maintenance work, especially in the Department of Higher Education. There are also, for this type of project going out for bid, a number of energy service companies that are very interested in, and they use a process where they provide financing and guarantee energy savings. Department of Administrative Services and Department of Justice have been working on a process to qualify bidders so that the state can do energy service contracting. We've done very little of it so far, but there's significant potential there, so I think we would use that as well. So, but you're right, the funding you're providing primarily would be providing funding audit work and evaluations, not the measures in that $2 million or $2.3 million.
One final question, and then I believe Representative Clem has a question. Most of our correctional facilities are relatively new. Some of them are quite old. Would we be looking at any of those facilities, particularly facilities like the Oregon State Penitentiary, the Oregon State Correctional Institution?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, very definitely. We have done a number of projects there, but there are in those older facilities, and same with some of DHS's facilities, but there's definitely more that could be done.
Obviously, we will have to maintain the state hospital until we have a replacement for it. So. Representative Plant.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to reiterate something said the other day that I'm particularly interested, like Representative Nolan's point it was, in the buildings that are being leased and other things, how we share in the cost of the audits with the owners. And I believe you mentioned the other day one element is that they're willing to do the things that we recommend from our audits, and so they make a lot of expansion. One, probably not a question because it's not happening now, but one thought would be, do they then roll those costs into our new rent payments? And so I just want to make sure if we do the audit, it's being recaptured somewhere.
That's a good point, Mr. Chairman, Representative Clement. In our own experience in our building, which is a rental, we pay our utilities separately because both the owner and we have invested in a number of energy savings measures, and we've seen real savings there. And he's been very good to work with in that regard.
Yes. Mr. Chair, on number 103, on the rural schools piece, the way the budgets work in school districts, I'm not sure if you know this or not, but if a school did save $100,000, is it such that it's kind of a general fund expenditure for energy and they could then plow it right back into classroom activities, ideally?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clown, I believe so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I myself am a big supporter of equalization and believe that education is a public good that all Oregonians, childless or not, rural or urban, have to share, and I really like this package particularly.
And actually, on that issue, there have been considerable questions about the adjustments we do in materials and services in terms of estimating school expenditures and the accuracy of those. And obviously, the portion for transportation is separate. Schools are actually compensated for that, but many have complained that their cost of energy to heat buildings and to cool buildings when necessary, that we're not really accounting for that accurately, and that some of this effort might reduce some of those costs and free them up for other purposes. So, any additional questions? Seeing none, we have Monday off, and then next week we have the Columbia Gorge Commission and the Marine Board. The Gorge Commission first and then the Marine Board Wednesday. And with that, thank you very much for
Thank you.
Staff for being here.